The Guardian.
Football Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. Make your next move and create your next website using Squarespace's all-in-one platform. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code Football Weekly to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain.
Welcome to an edition of Football Weekly Meets. I'm Paul McInnes, and here today with me in near-Earth orbit, I think we're still allowed to call it that, is the author Ross Raisin. Hi, Ross.
Hello.
And the reason we've got somebody who thinks for a living in the Football Weekly podcast is because you have written a novel, which is called A Natural, set in the world of football, specifically League Two football. Your previous novels, your protagonists have been farmers or shipbuilders. What led you to write a story inside the world of football?
Well, it's not necessarily a book strictly about football, but it is set in the world of football. And football, it's a very closed world in lots of different ways. So the institution of football and football clubs are very closed shops. And that's something I imagine we probably will go on to talk about, just the darkness that goes on behind the closed door. But it's also closed in the sense that you tend to find, or I certainly tend to find, just thinking about my friends, that people fall into, oh, I like football, or I actually really like football, I support a club, or, oh God, football, I hate football. And in lots of ways, fiction, or a certain kind of fiction, what's very unhelpfully called literary fiction, is quite similar in that there is an assumption on the part of, I would say, the world of publishing that and bookselling and literary prizes that certain subjects are not fit for literary fiction. And football, being probably the most populist subject there is one of those. And I just find that deeply frustrating because as somebody who loves football and loves reading, it's really annoying that those two things don't coalesce more often. Obviously, there's the very notable exception of David Peace.
Yes.
But there isn't very much else, and that's really annoying. So I think part of the stimulus for writing this book is a challenge to that orthodoxy, I suppose, of literary fiction, in that, yes, it can be about football. And I personally, I was writing this book thinking, I'd love to read a book like this. I don't mean that in a completely vainglorious way. But whether or not it's any good, I'd love to read a book about this world, and a book that explores characters and the life inside a football club in as full and thorough and, in some regards, investigative a way as this book intends to do.
There's one aspect of it which we can all engage with, I think, is the that your protagonist, your hero, if you can call him that, Tom Pearson, mm-hmm. He is a professional footballer, and he's sort of been discarded by Premier League Academy at the age of 18 and sort of ends up at Town in League Two, gets a professional contract. But he is also a football fan, and he's an obsessive. His main mode of communicating with his father is through talking about football, and there's some very evocative passages when he as much remembers going to watch football matches with his dad as a kid. You grew up watching Bradford City.
Yeah.
Is that inform those memory passages? And talk to me about your experiences of growing up watching football.
It totally has. This is the thing. It's an absolutely fundamental part of my life, and not just the enjoyment of a Saturday going to watch Bradford, which sadly I don't do as often as I'd like now because I don't live near Bradford. But I went to my first match when I was 7, and it's in some ways the bedrock of my relationship with my father. That was our time together, and that sense of community, I suppose, is what football is about to me. So the community of me and my dad, the slightly wider community of the other people that we used to go to the matches with, and the idea of a fan base. And the matches that I do go to now in some ways do encapsulate that even better now, because I mainly go to away matches, which are, that's the real community of the football team. And I'm steeped in that, and it's intractable from who I am, I feel. And so in that sense, writing this book was probably more enjoyable than other books that I've written, because I could bring all of that into it. And also I can bring into it all of the guff that I've stored over the years of pointless. Yesterday afternoon, for example, I found myself on the internet just Googling statistics about Bradford's new striker. We've got this new guy called Charlie Wyke, started extremely well, got him in the January transfer window. And it became really important for me to know exactly how tall he is. So I went on the the club website, Wikipedia, Soccer Base, all these places where you go looking for exactly, and nobody's got it exactly. But that kind of stuff, I've been doing that for 30 years, not just about Bradford, but just generally. And finally, hallelujah, I've got somewhere to pour it out.
It's funny how that works, because I remember when I, in a period in my 20s when I thought that my memory was disappearing. I thought I was into early onset dementia or something. And there was one thing I clung to was that I could remember the name of Bolton Wanderers reserve keeper, which at the time was Jussi Jäskeläinen. So I was like, this is it. I can still remember some stuff. And it's funny how that sort of obsessive nature of football makes you sort of, yeah, I need to know the height of these things. And I can remember the height of these people.
But it does. And even sort of on the level beneath your own love, your own football team, there's all sorts of stuff that's stored away there. So for me, Bolton is quite associated, the football club Bolton is quite associated with lots of memories of my childhood. Just because I had a friend at school who supported Bolton, I always hated Bolton. But I went with him to Wembley to watch them play Reading in the playoff final. Right. I went with him to Everton, I went with him to Liverpool. I don't know why I went with him to all these matches, actually. But so I remember, you know, all these players, Alan Stubbs and John McGinley, and they're very much buried inside my subconscious alongside a cast of thousands of footballers and statistics that they're just there. And some of that, I think, has come out in this book.
Absolutely. And I certainly want to ask you about that. I mean, it's the obligatory death to modern football question. You talk about the away community there, and I think that's very interesting. You say it's the true community. What do you understand that to be?
I understand that to be the same people that you recognise when you go to those matches. And for a lot of people, they're the only times you'll see them. But the intensity of the relationship in that moment is probably more intense, more close, more intimate than a lot of the relationships that you have in your life that, in other regards, would probably count as your closest relationships. Yeah. Just because you are sharing something that means so much to you, and you know it means so much to them. And so there's a physical intimacy to that as well. You know, the moment of a goal being scored and the physical contact that you have with another person who otherwise you'd never talk to outside of a Saturday. And I suppose actually my relationship with my dad comes into this, actually, in terms of physical intimacy on that day, in that moment. And there's something about that that I don't think it's very easy to understand if you're one of these people who, you know, doesn't like football.
I still experience that at some home games, you know, if you're in a season ticket seat and you're with, but certainly, you know, an away community is the one where you really feel the passion and that people are there because they really want to be there and because they believe in the club and they believe that they have some responsibility to the club almost.
Yeah, there's something quite thrilling, I think, about seeing people in that moment of passion because, and again, you don't necessarily see it of them during the week, but in that moment, you will see them be a different kind of person, which is often wonderful, and sometimes you don't see them at their best. One quite distinctive memory I have of watching City is an away match against Southend, and we got thumped 4-0, and it was awful. And in fact, it was our lowest moment. That was our lowest point when we nearly got relegated out of the Football League. And at the end of the match, the players very sheepishly came over to the fans, and there weren't many. There was only 100, 200 of them. And One of the fans went to the front and just started railing and swearing and shouting at one particular player and saying, I'm not going to swear now, but imagine some swear words. You're not fit to wear the shirt. You're awful. You're off. And the player came back at him and shouted back at him and said, you F off. I'm not going to be here next season anyway. I don't know. I just like that because you don't get that at Premier League clubs particularly. And in fact, the player was there next season.
And
was our player of the season that season.
There you go.
He was great. Yeah.
Stories of redemption. Do you watch much of the game nowadays? Do you watch much of it, the televised version of the game?
Well, I can't because it's all gone off the telly.
And you don't pay Mr.
Sky.
Murdoch any money?
No, I don't pay him nothing. And I do miss that to a certain extent, yeah. But then again, sometimes I feel like I don't miss it that much because it's just not real. It's just it's a show, I feel, a lot of that, the telly football. Premier League is not, to me, it's completely disconnected from everything that I feel about football. And I find that quite sad. And I also think it's a problem. I think it's unhealthy because I think that that disconnect between the show of the Premier League and proper, real, difficult issues that need to be talked about and need to be talked about in a way that will help those issues. So the child abuse scandal being a big one. The disconnect makes it so hard for progress to happen, I think, in the conversation, I think, because football has enough money and enough power to be able to quash the conversations that need to happen. Investigations, you know, are supposedly ongoing, and the police investigations are ongoing with that particular matter of the child abuse scandal. But in terms of the club's private investigations that they're supposed to be doing, the FA's private investigation, how much are we going to hear from them about that, that is open and honest? I personally have my doubts about it, because I think that their primary goal is to make sure that they don't come out of it in a way that will tarnish their product. Mm-hmm. And I think that's extremely problematic.
I want to talk to you a bit about how you managed to get inside this world, because as you've already raised yourself, it's a closed one. And from my experience reporting on the game, particularly at the high end, access, as they call it, is difficult to get and limited when you get it, and given on preconceived terms which just limit the ways in which you can even talk within that space. But you spent a long time working on the book, at 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Talk us through it. It's obviously, you know, it's a labour of love to some extent.
Let's call it that. Let's call it a labour of love. That seems like a nice way of framing it. Yeah, it has taken that long. But the investment of thought that has gone into it and the investment of time and research has been very worthwhile, not just for the actual crafting of a book, which there is a satisfaction in when you get to the end of it, but also in the football side of it for me, because, you know, I like football. And so going into football clubs, talking to people, you know, I can't not be interested in that. And I have managed to speak and have proper, honest, open conversations with enough people, actually. Not that easy, because, of course, football clubs don't particularly want random novelists coming into their buildings wanting to talk to their players about all the things their players are trained not to talk about. Mm-hmm. Homosexuality, depression, sex. But I spoke about some of these things with players and had very enlightening conversations. But always, when you get them one-on-one, when they're outside of the group and they're outside of group think, you can have proper conversations. And I spoke to the thing is quite frustrating, but not surprising, is that I can't really name anybody.
No.
Simply because in the way that tends to happen with football, the sort of simplification, it'd be very easy to draw a line between people whom I might name, even though you might not have heard of them, and their clubs, and some of the stuff in the book that is extremely dark and based on research. But when I had those conversations, some of those fellas that I spoke to were very articulate, very intelligent, sensitive, emotional. I'll be honest, that came as a bit of a surprise to me.
How did you actually go about establishing contact with football clubs? And did you just write to them, say, I'm a novelist and I want to understand better?
It's mainly through, in some instances, yes, but mainly I would say it's through contacts, some of whom are inside football clubs. So the dad of a mate of mine, for example, was a director on the board at a football club. And I have other friends who are either inside the world of football or just outside, but close enough that they can point me in the right direction.
One of these people I see from the acknowledgements is a certain Max Rushton.
He's getting plugged every time I speak about this.
Occasional presenter of Football Weekly. And I just wondered, do you think you would have got a better novel had you been able to speak to AC Jimbo?
No, I think Max is definitely the go-to for any kind of anecdote. And he did actually grease the wheels for, I would say, probably my best contact, and somebody who I am happy to name because he's again outside enough of the dressing room that he can give me some anecdotes, but he's obviously not involved, which is the groundsman at Cambridge United, a guy called Ian Dahler, who's the most wonderful, funny and interesting fella that I could possibly have hoped to meet. And he gave me so much. So I just basically followed him around for a day or two, watching how he does his job. And just the amount of love that he has for that pitch, as well as knowledge and scientific ability, it was astounding and so wonderful to be around him doing it.
So some of the things you capture from this research, and there's stuff that seems timeless, but some of it which seems very contemporary. One thing that happens is there's a change of manager. and you go, it's basically like they go from Neil Warnock to Eddie Howe, from Clark to Wilco. And was that something you got a sense of, that there is still a vestige of the old ways of, you know, all about sort of like tough masculinity, and then the rest, there's a new breed coming on talking about, kind of, you know, a bit more like, I want to understand how you think and get the best out of you, a bit more sympathetic?
I definitely think that is true, actually. And I think that at lower league level, it's the divide is even more pronounced. So you still have your caveman figures, and I've got so many anecdotal things that I've heard about those caveman managers that is just, like, for example, one of them, one that Bradford fans hate. I'm not going to name him, but he's one that Bradford fans hate. And every lower league manager, every lower league fan hates. But anyway, in a dressing room at halftime, one player told me he had such a go at one of his centre-halves and abused him so much that the lad, he's in his late 20s and was a very hard man, certainly on the outside. He just started crying, just burst into tears, and I don't think went back on in the second half, and then was just got rid of, just put out on loan. But you do also have your more modern kinds of managers who are more interested in the science of things. But there's always, at lower league level, I think, this strange tension between the modernity and the money of football and the investment in sports scientists, all this kind of thing, and also just the way it's always been done. So, for example, on the way back from a Tuesday night away match, getting Domino's 2-for-1 pizza. I just love the fact that when one of the players told me that, I just thought, you're kidding. You don't actually get a Domino's 2-for-1 pizza on the way. It's like, yeah, of course we do. It's 2-for-1. But there's such a schism, I think, in that sort of, this is how it's always been done. And, oh, this is how some of the Premier League people do it. So we're going to do it like this. And we can sort of afford to do it. But they've never, I don't think many of the clubs get the balance quite right.
No, and also when the eye of the manager is off them, things operate differently.
That is definitely true, yeah. I think. Although I don't think I'm quite close enough to know exactly all of the bad stuff that goes on, because players, of course, are quite guarded, naturally enough, about that. And I think they're slightly fearful as well, because they're a little bit worried about being caught out with bad stuff. And especially because the proliferation of talk about behind-the-scenes stuff on social media,
yeah,
fans forums, for example, and some of the things that have come to light in recent years, which to me are indicative of conversations that I've had, like players, for example, hotel rooms, bringing girls back. I had one or two players who said to me, yeah, when players do that, when they bring a girl back to a hotel room, the first thing they'll do is text some of their friends to come down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I heard that, my heart sank out of my arse, because it's just awful. But I think it's endemic. I do think it's endemic.
You talk about the dark stuff, and you've described it yourself with a degree of reluctance, I fear, as the gay footballer novel. And
tongue in cheek.
Yes.
I might be saying it like that, yeah.
But, you know, the dark stuff pertaining to this is the secrecy with which a gay footballer has to keep his love, his passion, quiet from everybody, nobody can know. Do you think this novel needed to be written from that particular point of view?
Well, one of the things that's interesting, and sometimes quite frustrating about writing any novel, is that you have no control over topicality. So I began this book, as you kindly reminded me, years ago.
At the turn of the millennium.
Yes, somewhere around there. So I wrote a short story that then seeded the first chapter of this novel in 2011. So that's 6 years ago. At which point, as a conversation, homosexuality in football was not really being spoken about at all. Since which, a number of things have happened. For example, a couple of former players coming out, and the conversation has escalated. In that way, maybe it is quite good that the book is coming out now. But for me, it's most useful that the book is coming out now, because I would like to have conversations about that issue that are perhaps a little bit more nuanced and different from the more familiar conversation about the topic of homosexuality in football, which to me has now slightly collapsed into the general football thing of there's only one note to it. There's, oh, it's terrible, it's the last taboo, and, you know, there must probably be one in every Premier League squad, and they can't admit it to anybody. And I just think that's too simple. I think that it's frustrating that everything becomes about the Premier League. Nobody's interested in anything underneath the Premier League. But also, that's not the point, I think. What's interesting to me, and certainly is interesting to the novel, is the idea that if you are one of these young lads that grows up inside the banter bubble of a football club, you don't necessarily understand what gay is. It's a very heteronormative world in which homosexuality is not present. And so if you then come to feel something about yourself that is outside of what you view, what you term as normal, you probably are deeply confused and probably have quite a lot of self-loathing going on. This is what happens with the main character. And that I find more interesting than there must be secretly gay players. You know, there are secretly gay players. I'm aware of some, you're probably aware of some. It's beside the point. It becomes about the salacious interested in, oh, who's in the closet? But I think it's much more interesting, the idea of trying to understand yourself. What is your identity if you come from a very, very insular and retrograde world, as football is, as youth teams are?
Yes, I agree with you 100%. I just do wonder whether the secrecy and the inability for anybody to be able to come out in the world of football is not, well, A, it's a bit of a damning verdict on the culture within football, and whether that doesn't, whether it isn't important, given how important football is in the culture, that this hasn't been able to change. Because I was talking with a friend not so long ago, and I was saying, when the first elite footballer comes out as gay, they will be an icon. That was my... I had a couple of beers. I thought it'll be an icon. They'll be marketed around the world. It'll be a massive transformative event. Reading your book, and also the recent things, just like reading about musicians and things and actors who are still in the closet, where it's a much more, one would think, a culture which is much more accommodating and understanding. Mm. I just wonder, actually, is it just still, it's impossible for somebody to come out, particularly in the Premier League?
Well, it seems to be, because nobody has done. Yeah. And there are one or two players who may come out, who knows when, who are already icons. And you just think, it would be amazing if you came out, but I don't necessarily think that it would be this big transformative event. I know everyone's geared up for it being, oh, we're going to say it's going to be brilliant, it's going to be so positive, we're going to support you so much. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. And if you look to the example of other sports, you know, a lot of major sports in this country have got their one gay man. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Rugby Union has got Gareth Thomas, almost a decade since he came out. Rugby League's got Keegan Hurst, cricket's got Stephen Davies, but nobody's followed them. And I think that football, especially the institution of football, the FA, football clubs, the Premier League, are very guilty of wanting the onus to be on the individual. It's not their call. They're saying, well, we'll support you if you come out, but it's for you to do it. Whereas actually, I think the onus doesn't need to be, the pressure doesn't need to be on those individuals to come out and them change the world. Football needs to change its own world first in order to create a culture in which it's okay and normal for them to come out. And I think just the attention that would come to bear on that first player would be so extreme, especially if they were quite high profile. That's the main thing, I think, that is preventing players from coming out. That, and of course the fear of outside of their own hemisphere, I suppose, so away fans, the internet, there would potentially be some negative comeback there that nobody knows. And I think that it's preventative.
And also I wonder whether when it's something that's so, you know, if we're talking about an icon or whatever, or a professional footballer, that it's something so prominent that has so many people have an opinion on, that actually we reveal, or we don't like to think, that maybe we're less tolerant as a society than we like to think we are. I mean, I think, you know, there's some elements in your book which I think are very judiciously done. There's a summer which goes wrong weather-wise, and there's just little bits and bobs which remind you that you're in 2015, 2016, and it's not the same as 2005 when you started researching and writing this book. And one of the things I wonder about this is we're seeing this post-Brexit Trump, all this sort of the resurgence of intolerance. And inside the minds of some of your characters in this book, they don't like the idea of a gay football. They don't like the idea of a gay colleague, of somebody in their orbit. And I wonder whether that's another thing, actually, that just plain straightforwardly, if somebody was to come out, there'd just be a lot of people who wouldn't like that.
Well, there would. I mean that latest headline survey that was done that found, I forget what the figures were, but It's quite a large number of people who openly said we would not be comfortable with there being an openly gay player inside our club, and a number of people statistically saying I would stop supporting the club if that happened. And of course, that's going to, and the same, whatever publicly they might say about it, the same perhaps ratios would exist within the dressing room. There is no doubt. And that is very much based on the fact that football is decades behind where mainstream society is. It's because of the closeness of the world, there's a lag. And it is changing. Things are improving, but they're improving very slowly. And if a player came out, there would undoubtedly be a lot of unpleasant stuff that they would have to go through. And for me, I think the biggest concern actually isn't necessarily the first player who will get a big sponsorship deal, for whatever that's worth, and a lot of support and positivity. But what happens to the next five then that come out? Because I worry that things might get worse before they get better once a player comes out, because it's a world, because of that idea of homosexuality not having particularly existed as an idea within the dressing room for the last, let's say, 10, 20 years, the fear of homosexual suspicion isn't there. They don't have to worry about being labelled gay. And you see that when you go into a dressing room. It's quite fascinating to me when you just watching how intimate they are with each other. They touch each other's bodies. They slap each other's bottoms. They talk about each other's... What's the word to use
penis.
On a podcast? Penis. Let's say penises. Yeah, they talk about each other's penises. They know each other's penises. Like, they're like friends to them. Literally, it's bizarre. And you just think, hang on, this is all a bit... This is homoerotic, isn't it? But it's not homoerotic. It's because... It's a bit like, to me, it's reminiscent of like being in Russia or a Banya in Russia or being in Iran or something, and the physical intimacy is a little bit more public.
It's actually quite enlightened in a way.
But it's not, because in some ways it's more tender and intimate and proper, but that's only because there's no fear of being gay. Once that becomes more of a thing, it becomes more of a, oh, so there are gay people, they do exist, then... What potentially could happen is that we could be in a situation like the 80s in which homophobia rises in parallel with it. And so within a dressing room, maybe on the terraces, homophobic abuse might increase.
Because people start... But surely, I mean, surely people are aware they're not entirely separate from the culture at large, footballers.
No, but they're cosseted. And that, I think... exists within the dressing room, but it also exists on the terraces. There's a certain protective barrier around you that I think for some people, and especially being en masse as well, being within a herd, makes you feel you can do things and get away with things that you know you wouldn't do otherwise. And so, for example, racism or race hatred. I know that we're told a lot that that's been tamped down. That doesn't exist as much as it used to. And yeah, it's true. It doesn't exist as much as it used to. But you go to a lot of football matches and you will witness abuse and racism that is of a level that would very much surprise people who don't go into football grounds that often. And, you know, I say this as a Bradford fan, and so I hear that often. Just Islamophobia. It's not uncommon to go to a Bradford match and opposition fans chant, "You're just a small town in Asia," or worse, or very commonly, chant "England."
Mm-hmm.
I went to a match a few years ago in which three sides, it was literally probably the biggest chant of the afternoon, three sides of the home ground started chanting "England." And there's a very insidious Islamophobia, obviously, involved in that. And I just couldn't believe that it was just... And, you know, you're watching policemen, stewards, and they're not doing anything because they don't even know that... They don't make the connection. And I phoned up the club afterwards and said, hang on a minute, do you know that this happened? And I just want to know if there's going to be any recourse, if you're going to put a statement on your club website or something to say, this is not okay. And they were just completely bewildered by it. They didn't even know who to put me in touch with. Eventually, they put me in touch with the stadium manager, and he was a lovely guy, and he was just like, he just said, what do you want me to do? I mean, it's not really racist, is it? They're just chanting "England." But there's a certain level of, I hesitate to use the word, because I almost don't want to, but hatred that exists inside the love of your own football team. For some people, I think, they express their love of their football team often through hatred or through abusing the other. And that, I suppose, is the fear of a gay player who might want to come out but is hesitant because of that expression of hatred as an expression of love.
You know, you capture the culture very well, and it's an incredibly macho culture. When you were researching it and writing it, and you've obviously got to know and enjoy the company of professional footballers, was there any way in which you could identify with that culture, or did it feel entirely alien?
That's an interesting question. I think that probably, in some regards, I do probably identify with that macho culture, or certainly the idea of masculinity. There's a very deeply entrenched old school view of what masculinity, what being a man is inside a football club. And there are certain things, not necessarily that I recognise within myself, but I certainly recognise from within my life and having been at school and having met and interacted with people and at times been expected to be a certain kind of person because I am a man. But I think the old schoolness of masculinity within football clubs is so entrenched and so extreme that it goes way beyond my own experience. So I heard things like, for example, one particular club where the young players were housed in a series of lodging houses, and the manager, this is from the 90s, I think, but nonetheless, the manager would take them out into the garden in the middle of the night, tell them to get naked, and they would stand on upturned buckets in the garden, and he would get a hose pipe and he would hose them down with cold water while they shout out, "I am not shy! I am not shy!" It's just a ludicrous thing to imagine, but also it's not. It completely fits with that kind of cauldron of masculinity training, which is still, I think, what being a young player inside a football club is.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to get a bucket and a hose this Friday
night. Now.
Try. Ross, the book is A Natural. It's already out, isn't it?
It's out, yeah.
Publisher, and where can you find it? Presumably everywhere.
I'm hoping you can find it in most bookshops. The publisher is Jonathan Cape.
Retails at a very reasonable $14.95.
Is that what it costs?
Something like that.
I'd pay that.
Yeah, exactly. So would I.
Would you?
Yes, I've got a free copy, actually, mate. I'm not going to go out and buy another one, you're right. I'm just going to keep this one. Ross, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Ross Raisin, this has been Football Weekly Meets. Thanks for listening.
Create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template from Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code FOOTBALLWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.